Hi everyone, I'd like to welcome you to the Austrian Circle. This is the program where we talk about the economics of freedom, here on WHOS Stores 91.7 FM. So the first article I want to read, we're going to talk a little bit about regulations on the show today. I think that people don't really understand the damages that regulations do. They see that maybe it's helping because of safety issues or something like that, but they don't see the alternatives. Economics is really about seeing the alternative costs of action. What could we have done otherwise? And what sort of incentive structure does the market provide to encourage safety? How do we build safety in a marketplace? When we, the consumers, want to be safe, we, the laborer, wants to be safe, we, the entrepreneur, want to be safe, how do we build that without the use of regulations? Because what regulations do is monopolize or cartelize the market. They make it so that some employers have a benefit over other employers. The ones that can afford the regulations can keep their business in business, whereas the people who cannot afford to adhere to those regulations, but who might have been able to provide a high-quality product anyways, are kicked out of the market. They can't afford to keep up with all of the regulations that the larger companies can afford to. They can hire the whole legal team in order to comb through all the regulations, make sure that their I's are dotted in places that the government wants their I's to be dotted. And as a result, you end up getting fewer options as a customer, which makes us poorer overall. A monopoly can charge whatever it is that they want. And when you get all of the other competitors out of the market through things like regulations, you're going to see lower quality products, you're going to see higher costs, and you're going to see that the customer is certainly less well off than they otherwise would have been. So the first article I want to read is by Christopher Westley, and it's called Labor and Energy Regulations Take Us to the Cleaners. My clothes dryer went bust the day after Christmas, leading to one of the more common frustrations we face in the modern nation state. You see, there was a time when one's dryer broke that the owner faced two options. One, have it repaired, or two, buy a new one. The owner would weigh the costs and benefits of each, make a decision, and then move on to other things. But those days are gone. Now, when an appliance goes on the fritz, a dreaded third option is increasingly being foisted upon us, that of fixing it yourself. Now, self-repair was probably a more common choice back during my grandfather's generation. But as the economy expanded and per capita incomes grew, the time spent repairing one's own appliances meant less time working in the market. Towards the end of his career, my grandfather, the owner of a sheet metal business in Waukesha, Wisconsin, probably paid others to repair his appliances so he could be better focused on serving his own customers. This is one example of how the expansion of wealth made possible under capitalism leads to the creation of new jobs that did not exist previously. With my own broken dryer, I could have dipped into savings and bought a new low-end model, but this was an option I wanted to avoid. I could have contracted a repair service, but the cost could have easily reached the price of a new machine. Both outcomes result from restrictions on market forces that hinder both the supply of dryers and the availability of repair. Quote, Energy Star compliance standards on appliances have increased production costs so as to cartelize this industry while providing only negligible benefits in terms of power efficiency. Meanwhile, labor market interventions, especially on the entry side of the market, have reduced the supply of repairmen, thus allowing existing repairmen the ability to claim higher wages than they would otherwise. For people like myself who do not live in a big city, even finding a repairman can be difficult. The end result. The effects of government failure were reaching into my home and savings. Worse, they were forcing me to embrace the dreaded third option. I chose to fix the dryer myself. This decision was not made gleefully. I am not a tool guy. My comparative advantages tend not to include ratchet sets and elbow grease. What's more, I resented being forced to teach myself skills my grandfather and his generation gladly gave up when market forces developed to a point at which they could. My situation smacked of societal devolution, poking its cloven hoof into my laundry room. but I plowed ahead and soon learned I was far from being alone in my predicament, and that, in fact, huge masses of individuals across the country are being forced by similar artificial circumstances to take on last-minute appliance repair training against their will. In response, the internet is today chock-full of repair manuals that can be accessed after a few clicks into a search engine, while there are thousands of repair-oriented YouTubes uploaded by heroic experts explaining how to diagnose and then repair seemingly any appliance problem. Tasks such as replacing a dryer motor or belt become much less daunting when you can watch someone else do it, step by step, in a video that's posted by a professional and played by a novice. All for a zero price. While I watched several such videos, it occurred to me that they were part of a vast, spontaneous, decentralized, and unregulated training system that has emerged to counter the adverse effects of government intervention. Which led me to ponder, as I unplugged my dryer and pulled it away from the wall, what similar market innovations developed in the former Soviet Union that made life somewhat bearable there? As the size and scope of government in the United States grows, what further workarounds will people be forced to instigate to make life bearable here? Will subversive videos explaining do-it-yourself surgery pop up on once prices in healthcare are completely abolished? These spontaneous training systems are far from perfect. They are clearly second best, with first best being those market options made unseen and unattainable due to violent interventions in the market. But they're more than good enough. I'm proof of it. If an economist like me, who was heretofore unaware that ratchets were measured in both inches and centimeters, can replace a dryer belt and motor with the help of a few hastily found YouTube friends, then they serve much more than the social good. They also serve the poor, especially who suffer the most when government restricts market choice. That article was by Christopher Wesley. It's called Labor and Energy Regulations Take Us to the Cleaners. And I think it does a really great job of kind of pointing out how the government interventions into the market actually devolve society. They actually take away some of the economic benefits that we've managed to gain over time. So before, you just call a repairman, they'd come over, they'd fix it. Now the cost for that is so high that we have to actually learn skills that we don't really need to learn. I could be spending time learning more about my job so that I can become more valuable there. I could spend time with my children. I could spend time with leisure. I could spend time with any number of other things than having to sit on a YouTube video and learn a skill that doesn't even really apply to me. Now, some people might find it fun to go and repair their dryer. But the fact is that when government outlaws or makes so unattainable the cost of a particular good or service, they are devolving society. We go back towards the Stone Age when this happens. And I think this article really does a great job of pointing that out. So the next article I want to read is called Why There Should Be a Free Market in Food Labeling. And this talks about the genetically modified organisms debate. Voters in Washington state recently rejected a measure that would have required foods containing genetic engineering to be labeled. California voters did the same thing in 2012. Genetically modified foods are derived from genetically modified organisms, GMOs, that have been altered to contain a new protein or proteins. This is done by changing the code or sequence of DNA, the blueprint for making proteins. The plant or animal, but nearly all GMOs used in production agriculture are plants, is then cultivated and produces the new protein or proteins, which confers new characteristics on the plant. For example, some corn has been genetically altered to produce a protein that is toxic to insects. The purpose of this article is not to discuss the suitability of those techniques to create food products, their effectiveness, safety, or how they came to be in the first place. The larger question I wish to address is whether or not GMO labeling should be mandated by governments. Shortly before the GMO vote in Washington state, Michael Lipsky explained why GMO labeling requirements would not increase food prices. In the article, he states, Quote, "For one thing, if labeling were required, particularly if and when the labeling requirement is adopted by other states, demand for non-GMO versions of corn, soybeans, and sugar beets, the basic GMO crops, would increase, production would expand, and prices for non-GMO ingredients would decline. The result would be a new price equilibrium, surely less costly for food producers than the cost of current non-GMO ingredients." He goes on to say the following, quote, "For another, if foods with GMO ingredients indeed were cheaper to produce, there would be an ongoing demand for the less expensive versions of both products, and some GMO foods would find a market niche at a lower price point." The analysis here is correct. Producers and consumers interact. Supply and demand leads to prices which reflect this information, and the market reaches some sort of equilibrium. But all of this misses the point. Food producers shouldn't be required to give this information. Food companies should be able to put whatever they want on the labels of their products, and consumers will tell them if it is enough information by choosing to purchase their products or by not purchasing them and by going somewhere else. The government is simply not required in this process, and legislation almost always creates more problems than it solves. One problem lies in determining what exactly GMOs are. It's not as straightforward as you might think. Could food companies simply put a boilerplate label on each product, quote, "may contain GMOs," for example, and satisfy the regulation? Who is responsible for enforcement and what is now not being dealt with as a result of this new policing requirement? In many cases, when labels are used, it's not always clear what constitutes a GMO and what does not. The typical thinking is that a GMO plant has, quote, "foreign genetic material inserted into its genome and is made by one of several large agribusinesses." What this definition ignores is the natural occurrence of GMOs, including the transfer of toxins, without human intervention. On the other hand, if the goal is to label foods modified by human intervention, this would encompass virtually everything that we eat. Plants and animals have been selectively bred for thousands of years by humans. This has encouraged the retention of certain genetic traits over others, and therefore, every food product could be considered a GMO. Whenever labeling guidelines are mandated by the government, the first order of business for the manufacturer is to meet these legal requirements. This may or may not satisfy consumers. It seems that, had these labeling laws been passed in Washington or California, food manufacturers could have simply put GMO or may contain GMOs, or to the best of our knowledge, this product is likely to contain GMOs, on the every label and satisfy the requirement. Examples given in the Washington State Initiative seem to indicate that this generic language could be used. This would result in consumers actually having less information than they did before the labeling requirement went into effect. This effect was demonstrated when the FDA required nutrition information to be labeled on food products. By mandating what must be included on the label, food producers seek first to satisfy this requirement. While some products do contain additional information on the label, this is always included after all of the mandates have been met, even when consumers don't care about the mandated information on a product that they may be using for other reasons. Enforcement is another problem with these labeling requirements. The Washington State Initiative mentions the punishment portion of violating the law, but says nothing about who would take samples, conduct or pay for GMO testing, or what tests would be appropriate. If this task is forced on state agricultural officials, what other duties would now be neglected? Perhaps something more important than enforcing a GMO labeling law. In partial agreement with Mr. Lipsky, food manufacturers claimed and produced studies indicating that GMO labeling requirements would raise food prices. From these studies, the article states that, quote, "food costs for the average family would increase by several hundred dollars a year." In addition, compliance with the new requirements could be accomplished, quote, "by using certified non-GMO ingredients or organic inputs." Many people don't want to pay more for anything with higher-priced ingredients, perhaps especially food, but food companies themselves substitute ingredients in or production practices for products all the time and charge them more for it, in the hopes that consumers will buy these premium products. For example, Eggland's Best eggs are produced with costly practices that enhance the nutrient content of the eggs, and this features prominently as marketing on their packaging. As a result, they charge more for this food product compared with other eggs. Food companies bring a staggering array of products onto the market on a regular basis, ever-evolving attempts to adapt to changing preferences and price points. And by doing so, they raise prices on their products all the time. This is only a natural consequence of changing how something, anything, is made. Prices reflect these changes, and consumers' choices indicate if the changes should have been made in the first place. A product that is priced beyond what consumers are willing to pay or able to pay will not stay on the market very long. The articles from Lipsky and the food manufacturers both miss the point. The price of any good or service could be altered through state regulation of labeling GMO products and new price equilibrium established, but there is no need for this to happen. Producers and consumers can and do take care of this on their own. Also, prices rising and falling is a natural consequence of any functioning market. The price is a signal to producers and consumers and is used to allocate scarce resources such as food. Rising prices create opportunities for producers, while falling prices indicate that either demand for the good or service is declining, or the supply is too abundant relative to demand. It is the distortion of these pricing signals that causes the real problems, not the fact that prices rise and fall. So, it is widely known that some consumers care whether or not they are eating GMO foods, while others do not. Food producers are listening. A similar process occurred when the organic food movement began many decades ago. A, quote, new food market was created based on consumer demand. There is no reason to think that food choices and labels can't change without legal mandates from the government. In fact, it is mandates that would remove choice and knowledge on labels of food products for consumers. Again, that article was by David Albin. And it was called Why There Should Be a Free Market in Food Labeling. Now, in keeping with that same idea of GMO labeling, a new development has come into place out of the Affordable Care Act. Apparently, there are some regulations in there that require vending machines to put caloric information onto their vending machines. And this article is called We Have to Pass the Bill to Find Out What's in It by David Boaz, and it's on beforeitsnews.com. The Affordable Care Act is like a big box of Christmas presents. You keep rummaging around in the peanuts and find hidden treasures, or hidden costs, as it were. Here's one I hadn't heard of until today. Office workers in search of snacks will be counting calories along with their change under new labeling regulations for vending machines, including in President Barack Obama's healthcare overhaul law. Requiring calorie information to be displayed on roughly 5 million vending machines nationwide will help consumers make healthier choices, said the Food and Drug Administration, which is expected to release the final rules early next year. It estimates the cost to the vending machine industry at $25.8 million initially and $24 million per year after that, but says that if just 2.02% of these obese adults are ate 100 fewer calories a week, the savings to the healthcare system would be at least that great. The rules will apply to about 10,800 companies that operate 20 or more machines. Nearly three-quarters of those companies have three or fewer employees, and their profit margin is extremely low, according to the National Automatic Merchandising Association. An initial investment of $2,400 plus $2,200 in annual costs is a lot of money for a small company that only clears a few thousand dollars a year, says Eric Dell, the group's vice president for government affairs. The money that would be spent to comply with this, there's no return on the investment, he said. In my experience, vending machines shuffle their offerings fairly frequently. If the machine operators have to change the calorie information displayed every time they swap potato chips for corn chips, then $2,200 seems like a conservative estimate of costs. But then, as Hillary Clinton said when it was suggested that her own health care plan would bankrupt small businesses, quote, I can't be responsible for every undercapitalized small business in America. And what's going to happen here is going to be exactly what always happens in these kind of situations. They make some conservative estimates about how much stuff is going to cost, and then, of course, it's extremely more costly than that. All of these vending machines are going to have to raise their rent to the companies who have the vending machines in their workplaces and stuff like that. Maybe the company will decide that it's too costly now. They're not going to have the vending machine. Perhaps people are just going to bring in their own snacks, you know, because it's so the prices would rise on the items that are fed out of the vending machine. So people just bring in their own snacks. It's not going to save the healthcare of the nation. There's a deeper underlying problem there that you can't just push around by passing a law here and pushing or nudging, as they like to call, consumers in a particular direction. I don't count calories myself. I just eat good food. I eat mostly organic, mostly vegetables. And I make my own almond milk from scratch. I do a lot of things to make sure that I'm getting high quality food into my diet. I don't generally count calories, however. And so, you know, this idea that people will be healthier as soon as you put nutritional information on everything, I don't think that that works. And that might be what the consumer wants. People will buy what they want to buy. If a particular vending machine company starts putting nutritional information on their vending machine and people like it better, they prefer that one, they buy more of that particular machine, then we've found out something very informative about what other people's preferences are. But what we don't have to do is pass laws and force people to do these things. They're going to do it on their own if they want to, if they find it to be of benefit to them. So finally, I want to read an article by Mark Thornton, and this is actually a spoiler article. So if you have not and plan on seeing the Dallas Buyers Club, I would hope that you would change the station right now. But this is going to be about the FDA, one of the larger regulatory bodies in this nation. When the FDA declared war on a Texas AIDS patient. The Dallas Buyers Club is based on a true story about Ron Woodruff, a redneck, heterosexual Texan who contracts the HIV virus in the 1980s. There is lots of sex, drugs, drinking, homosexuals, and even transsexuals, in addition to great acting, so be warned, this movie is not for everyone. However, it teaches us many lessons about how the state and its agents work. This is essentially an anti-government movie that exposes the true relationship between the American Medical Association and Big Pharma, and reveals it as a crony capitalist network that exploits Americans and especially their health. The hero is just an ordinary guy, and the heroine is just an ordinary doctor who come to realize the widespread fraud in the American medical establishment and stands up against it. Spoiler alert, the rest of this article contains spoilers. Our hero, Ron Woodruff, ends up in the hospital and learns that he has contracted HIV. This stunning revelation starts him searching for the causes and cures for HIV-AIDS. While researching the disease, he comes across information that the drug AZT might offer a cure. It just so happens that the pharmaceutical company that has a monopoly on AZT has just finalized a deal to begin the first human clinical trials, coincidentally, at the hospital where Woodruff is being treated. To be fair, the FDA did, quote, fast-track the human trials because of public uproar, but the FDA still bars our hero from access to AZT. Woodruff begins by buying stolen AZT, but his access to local AZT is eventually cut off. Woodruff's search for this drug takes him into Mexico, where he finds a doctor, formerly from the U.S., who tells him that AZT alone is poisonous and ineffective, and that it is actually harmful because it destroys good and bad cells in your body. The doctor shows Woodruff research that supports his claim and tells him that he treats HIV-AIDS patients with a combination of vitamins, minerals, and natural supplements, and other medicines that can help improve health and slow the progression from HIV to AIDS. All the individual components of the doctor's treatment are considered safe by the FDA. Unfortunately, the treatment as a whole is unapproved for treating HIV-AIDS, and the FDA forbids doctors from prescribing them in such cases. Our hero gets the idea that he can buy large quantities of these supplements and medicines in Mexico, where they are legal, and resell them in the U.S. for a profit. Of course, he is stopped and harassed by the Border Patrol and the FDA. Eventually, he forms the Dallas Buyers Club and sells memberships so that people can obtain these products without breaking the law. Woodruff is further harassed by the IRS and the FDA, who attempt to shut down his business. The movie shows the concoction of supplements and medicines as being largely effective in keeping HIV patients healthy and alive. In contrast, the HIV patients in the AZT trials are failing badly, getting sick, and dying at an alarming rate. Woodruff discusses what he has discovered and the results he has seen with club members with his U.S. doctor. She is already alarmed by the results of the AZT trials and eventually puts all of her asymptomatic patients on the lowest possible dosage. She then approaches the director of the hospital about her concerns over the widening failure of the hospital's clinical trials of AZT. He dismisses her concerns, declaring the research a success, and refuses to allow her to see the written report. Eventually, the hospital asks her to leave her position. The science behind the treatment is not the focus of the movie. The focus is on the crony capitalist relationships that exist within the American healthcare system and the power they wield in stifling a person's right to consume what they want and treat themselves as they see fit. Near the end of the movie, Woodruff has brought a lawsuit against the FDA to be allowed to determine his own medical treatment. The judge laments that the law can be a very counterproductive and unethical tool in areas where the government has taken control, such as the determination of healthcare. The judge rules in favor of the FDA and dismisses the case. The American Medical Association is a monopoly cartel for doctors that dictates the range of healthcare and treatment options. Pharmaceutical companies are also monopolies that have patents on the drugs and devices they invent. The FDA reinforces these monopolies by requiring extremely expensive and sometimes unnecessary testing and compliance regulations that can run more than $1 billion for each new drug or device. Such procedures prevent many drugs from coming to the market in the U.S. despite being successfully used in other countries. This failure to approve helps market incumbents and hinders new competitors. It also harms consumers by depriving them of treatment options, driving up the cost of health insurance. One industry insider told me that there is a whole new category of medicine that improves detection of diseases, more effectively treats, cures, and prevents medical problems, and does so cheaper and with fewer side effects, but the research companies can't get past the FDA hurdles. One thing the movie does well is show how those in charge of these monopoly organizations have little concern for people's welfare, and how real doctors and patients are unable to effectively fight the system. It also depicts the police, the IRS, and border agents are the enforcement arm of this crony capitalist system. Most people never see the American medical establishment exposed for what it is. Dallas Buyers Club shows the system at its very worst, a crony capitalist combination of the profit motive armed with the vast enforcement power of the federal government. Again, that was Mark Thornton, when the FDA declared war on a Texas AIDS patient. So I hope that you enjoyed this show. I hope that you'll tune in next week for another episode of the Austrian Circle. Have a great week. Take care.